Welcome into another post-game edition of the Dana and Victory podcast. We're recording this on Friday, second day of the NCAA tournament, and last night Xavier came away with the 76-65 win over Maryland. Dan, it's funny. I think based on the reaction I've seen on social media, based on what I've seen on the message board, right now it feels like the Xavier fan base is kind of in just a euphoric state. Like, even though they knew because of the matchups that a win might be possible, they never really expected this team to be advancing in the NCAA tournament. Is that sort of accurately describe your feeling right now?
Yeah, I was. I certainly had hopes that Xavier would win yesterday. I wouldn't say I. Well, actually, no, I did expect them to win. This is actually a peek behind the curtain. By the way, you're getting my. You're getting another special guest, which is my 2-year-old Alex. Actually, not quite two. He's playing in the background, so I apologize to our many dozens of listeners. I thought based on the matchups and having seen Maryland play a little bit this year that Xavier would kind of go off on him. I didn't expect it to play out the way it did, obviously. I mean, I think that it was pretty touch and go for X for the middle portion of the game. But, yeah, generally, I think I get the same vibe as you do from the interactions I have on Twitter and on social media and everything else, that people were kind of looking at this as they kind of viewed Xavier making the NCAA tournament as a little bit of a victory in itself, given the struggles they had in league play and given all the adversity they faced off the court with injuries, et cetera. But beating a Big Ten team, beating a kind of a name brand school like Maryland, it's great, and it puts Xavier in a situation now where they're kind of playing with house money, I feel like, for the season, which is good because it sure looked bad. It sure did not look great toward the end of February.
I think we have to start with, to me, the biggest story is if you're Sean O'Mara. And you just woke up, which, by the way, I was looking at Twitter a few minutes ago, and in my activity feed, I saw him favoriting several tweets. So I just have to imagine, after the season you've had, which, let's be honest, it was kind of a disappointment for Sean. Like, he wanted to come in. He wanted to be the starting five. He got that opportunity early in the year. He lost it. At times, he barely got off the bench this season, and there was a stretch where he was hardly playing at all. Then to have his career high in the NCAA tournament last night, really carry this team during the first half when Trayvon Blewett was nowhere to be found and J.P. McCura was struggling and they really didn't have a good source of offense. To go 5 of 6 from the field, 8 of 9 from the free throw line, grab 7 boards, have a really nice assist, a couple other nice passes, no turnovers in 21 minutes. What this morning has to be incredible for him to just be scrolling through these tweets where every Xavier fan and all these national guys are tweeting his name and everything. It's got to be an awesome morning for that guy.
It's St. Patrick's Day, too.
Great point.
What else would you expect for a guy named Sean O'Mara the day before St. Patrick's Day?
Alex liked that.
My kid. He didn't like my joke. Yeah. It's all right, buddy. So, yeah, I mean, O'Mara was terrific in this game. I don't think there's any question about it. It was a favorable matchup for Xavier. Maryland's bigs aren't very good. Dodd is kind of just an oaf out there, and the other kid they brought on had some offensive skills but didn't seem to have much of a clue defensively. Sean took the opportunity that was handed to him, and he did better than anyone could have expected. And so, I mean, I think it's a really nice testament to the hard work he's put in. Because you're right, there's been times this season, especially, where it looked like, you know, maybe that was all he was going to be, was a depth big guy, and he wasn't going to get to the place where he wanted to be when he arrived at Xavier. And I mean, you and I know from going to practice. I mean, the kid works his butt off in practice. He really takes the puts forth a great effort. He concentrates on his footwork. He's coachable. He listens to Coach Pegues, and just sometimes it hasn't come together on the court during games for him. So for that to happen last night was terrific. And hopefully, I mean, it's going to be a very, very different and more difficult test against FSU's bigs on Saturday, but at least he's coming into the game with some confidence.
There are two other guys that I thought were really important early in the game, aside from obviously what Trayvon Blewett did in the second half. And that was Malcolm Bernard, who hit a big three, ended up with 6 points, had 6 boards and 2 assists during a lot of that came in the first half, where I thought he was playing aggressive and a few times maybe even stepping outside of his comfort zone, doing a little too much. He did have two turnovers. But from my perspective, that Malcolm Bernard at least being a weapon, at least being a guy that the defense has to account for and realizes on the court, is so much more valuable to this team than the guy who maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago during the losing skid was just out there and didn't attempt shots and maybe grabbed a rebound occasionally, but really just wasn't a factor at all that the defense even had to consider. Whether he's making shots or getting a few too many turnovers or not, to me, him being aggressive and just being a threat is so much more valuable to this team. And quite honestly, last night, I felt he helped carry them again during that first half where they were struggling. The second guy is Quentin Gooden. And obviously, he's had his struggles with finishing. He's had some turnover issues, and he did last night. He fought through some bad turnovers there in the first half. But at the end of the game, he has a couple really nice finishes. He ends up 3 for 7 from the field with 9 points, 5 boards, 9 assists. And, of course, he had the 5 turnovers. But 9 assists to 5 turnovers in 39 minutes, you can take from a freshman point guard in the NCAA tournament.
Well, the other thing, yeah, and I thought the first half was really the triumph of Xavier's role players because, as you mentioned, I mean, I think Trayvon was 1 for 8 from the field with 4 turnovers in the first half,
yeah,
or something like that. He just was not plugged in, and it was Malk, it was Sean, and it was especially Quentin, I thought, in that first half that kept Xavier afloat and actually had them leading for, I mean, what, like 19 minutes out of the 20? And yeah, I mean, I thought he was, I thought both those guys were terrific. And the other great thing about those two is I thought that they both really played hard on the defensive end, and that was not a simple game for Xavier from a defensive standpoint, for individual players, for Xavier from a different standpoint, because they were shifting defenses quite often. They were going to the 2-3 zone. They were playing the 1-3-1 zone. They went to man-to-man a couple of times. They were doing shifting things on out-of-bounds plays. So it was challenging. And you're also dealing with a really top-flight point guard in Melo Tremble with Maryland and a backcourt that really causes you some problems because they're so small and they're so quick. So I thought both those guys did a terrific job as well.
Well, let's talk about the defense for a second because that was a hot topic of conversation throughout the game last night. And they came out in a man-to-man. After maybe a handful of minutes, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, they switched pretty much to the zone for the rest of the half. They changed between a 2-3 and a 1-3-1 and maybe went back to man-to-man for a few possessions. But basically, the gist was the idea, the game plan, was going to be to throw different defenses at Maryland throughout. Because quite honestly, Maryland just doesn't run that much offensively. And if you watch them on film, a lot of their offense just relies on putting the ball in Trimble and Cowan's hands, having them create off of ball screens or isolations, draw fouls, kick to shooters. They're really difficult to cover in man-to-man. They're really good at putting pressure on your guards not to foul. And right away out of the gate, Quentin Gooden had 2 fouls, Malcolm Bernard had 2 fouls, and there went the idea of being able to switch it up and go back to the man-to-man a little bit and jump some ball screens. So they had to play the zone the rest of the half. They survived in it. Yes, they gave up some threes, but quite honestly, they weren't getting carved by what Maryland wants to do, which is Trimble and Cowan breaking you down off the bounce. They have some guys that can shoot, but they're not really running a lot to get those guys open, right? It's just they're getting some shots off of ball movement against the zone, and they're hitting them at an okay clip, but it's not like they were setting the world on fire. People were really upset. They wanted Xavier to get out of the zone. In the second half, you saw the full game plan. When they were not worried about the foul trouble any longer, they were able to cycle through the zones and the man, consistently changing it up. And really, I thought Maryland just looked like a team that doesn't have a lot there on offense. I don't think they're all that well coached. I'm not sure how well of a job Mark Turgeon does in terms of making adjustments and getting his teams to run stuff because they were confused at different times. They threw the ball all over the place. They finished with only 11 turnovers. 6 of them were in the second half, but I thought some of them were at really crucial moments where Xavier would go to 1-3-1 for a possession, and they just kind of toss the ball to X and give up a really bad turnover, a live ball turnover in a crucial moment. And I agree with you. I thought the defensive game planning was almost perfect in this game by the Xavier coaching staff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact is that Xavier, because of their personnel issues, doesn't have a huge margin for error when they're playing NCAA tournament teams. But the nice thing about playing Maryland, I mean, I'll be honest with you, Rick. As Xavier was playing Maryland, I kind of had a feeling. I was watching Maryland, and I was like, this team is way worse than the team Xavier's been playing for the last 2 or 3 months. I mean, when you think about it, granted, let's leave DePaul out, but Xavier's last, like 19 of Xavier's last 22 games, or maybe 21 of, or actually more than that, 21 of 24 or something like that, have been against NCAA quality talent. Tournament teams, Big East, UC, and Maryland, frankly, is not as good as most of those teams. And you kind of saw Xavier get into a comfort zone in the second half that I just have not seen them in really at any point during at least the league schedule. They hit a rhythm. They got on a nice long run. They were putting together defensive stops. They were getting baskets in transition. You saw Kaiser Gates step out on the floor, hit a couple threes. Guys were getting involved. There was a nice mix between dribble drives and spot up shots. There were times where I was like, "Is this the same team that I've been watching for the last 3 months?" And then you have the last like 2 minutes of the first half, and I'm like, "Yes, this is the same team that I've been watching for the last 3 months," because they're capable of going into a funk in a hurry as well.
Yeah, and I think really, especially against that Maryland team, a big key for this Xavier team was not to worry about the funks, because Maryland's going to give it right back to you. Like, they go through those same exact spells where they turn the ball over inexplicably for 3 or 4 possessions in a row. So you can't get down about that, and you have to keep playing. I thought Xavier did a really good job of that. But yeah, when you look at like the Big Ten, you know, they get so much credit for being this tough conference, and yeah, this Maryland team did go to Michigan and win, and to Illinois and to Iowa and to Minnesota and to Ohio State and to Northwestern and win. But I agree with you, Dan. Like, I was watching Minnesota yesterday. That team's not as good as Providence and Marquette and Seton Hall, in my opinion. I'm with you. I think, and Chris Mack said it after the game. He said, "I don't think we were as beat up as everyone wanted to believe heading into the postseason. I think we play in a hellacious conference." And he's right. I mean, this Big East conference is tough. And the other side of it is, you mentioned the Xavier team not having a lot of margin for error. And the fact that they're just not quite as talented as you expected them to be or you'd like them to be. And what happens, I think, is when teams are more locked into Chris Mack's system and what Xavier does and what they're going to try to run and some of the quick hitters they're going to get you with, all of a sudden it takes away some of that margin for error that Xavier kind of has built in, right? Like, the third time or the second time you're playing these Big East teams that also have been coaching against Chris Mack for the last however many seasons that they've been in the Big East, it's a lot more difficult to get some of those things off. Whereas you get into the tournament, teams are preparing for you on short notice. They're not telling their kids, "Oh, okay, you've got their normal system down. Now remember that they're going to run this at you. They're going to run this at you. Oh, don't forget about this set. You've seen it before." That's all new to them. They're just trying to get down the basics. Here's the basic actions that they're going to run at you. Here's their defense, whatever. That's all they've seen. So Xavier has a lot more of that stuff that they can bring back out, run a few different times. They got the dumbass play off last night on an underneath out of bounds. All that type of stuff adds back into that margin for error, which I think really helps this Xavier team in the postseason.
Well, and I think, and I'm glad that you brought it up, because that was going to be the perfect example of it, is that everybody in the Big East is now well aware of the dumbass play, and Maryland fell for it hook, line, and sinker the first time they tried it.
So it's funny. It's funny every time, isn't it?
Well, and just having seen Florida State play this year, I suspect they will be ripe for the dumbass play.
Without question. They might still block it off the glass, but...
Yeah. I mean, it may get obliterated out of bounds. Speaking of block shots, I thought one of the plays of the game for me was Malcolm Bernard just obliterating Tremble on the first possession in kind of a transition look. I thought that set a tone. And I thought Xavier really defended well those first 4 minutes when they couldn't get any shots to go down. They did kind of a nice job of setting the tone and making it clear to Maryland it wasn't going to be easy. We got to talk about Trayvon in the second half. I mean, I don't know if he had some orange slices or a Gatorade or what it was, but everybody on the team should have like two of them before the next game. Because he went into a mode in the second half that I don't think I've seen a Xavier player in since Tu Holloway against Purdue his senior year. I mean, Trayvon was just everywhere. He was hitting everything. And when he gets into that mode, it makes life so much easier for the other guys on the team, doesn't it?
It really does. And It's interesting because before the Crosstown Shootout, we had Brad Redford on the Skinny podcast, and he brought up something that I thought was really interesting where he said, you know, great shooters and where Trayvon has to get to it is the point where you can make adjustments in game. When your shot's not there, you can figure out why and get it going. And I remember at the time us saying, like, Trayvon, that's been an issue for Trayvon throughout his career. It's he's an either he's on or he's not type of guy. And you know within the first several shots that he's taken, right? Miraculously, the second half of this season, he's been the exact opposite of that. He has absolutely been a guy who struggles a lot in the first half and then can turn it on and get insanely hot in the second half. And maybe part of that's me misremembering what he's done earlier in his career, but for the most part, I felt like that was a pretty consistent theme with him, where either he was on or he wasn't. And, I mean, that couldn't be farther from the truth right now, and it just makes it interesting, and I think it gives his teammates a lot of confidence because they see him struggling. And, like, last night, you know, you got a couple guys that just do enough to keep the team ahead or at least close at the half, and then he finds it. He figures it out. He makes the adjustment. And I don't know what that means for him, what he's figuring out in his head to get it fixed in game. But the way he's been able to turn it on the second half of these games, sure, you'd like to see him do it for the full game. But he's been unbelievable. And, I mean, some of the Big East games that we saw him in, the Big East tournament games, and then this one, the last few weeks have been really impressive. And you're getting to the point where if Xavier does pull an upset against Florida State, the professional opportunities become a lot more intriguing, I think, for Trayvon Blewett if he continues to play like this, because we've seen it before where a guy goes off just for a few weeks at the end of the season, people see enough from him, and it does raise their stock enough for it to be worth going. So we've been planning on Trayvon Blewett wanting to pursue professional options after this season for the whole year, and if he continues to play like this, I think it's going to be a lot easier for him to make that decision.
Sure. So looking ahead now to Florida State, obviously ACC power, they've been in the top 10 for most of the season, had a few hiccups along the way. They lost to Temple in the non-conference schedule, who's really bad. They also had a blowout loss at Georgia Tech, but Josh Pastner got a couple scalps this year in his first season in Atlanta. I just look at this team, and it's just an intimidating level of physicality and size that they bring to bear.
Yeah, I mean, they're the second tallest team in the country. Kumaje, their 7'4" big man, is just a ridiculous thing to deal with at the back end of their offense, because he's not a guy like they involve. He just stands kind of underneath the rim waiting for you to help up a little bit too much on one of their drivers, and then they throw a lob straight up at the top of the backboard and he goes and dunks it on your head. So how Xavier accounts for that and deals with that, I really have no idea. Like, I think he's going to get multiple dunks in this game off of lobs, and it's going to be really frustrating. Everyone's going to be, Xavier's defense sucks. But, like, quite honestly, they just don't have anything to combat that. They're going to have to give up some lobs at the rim to stop guys from getting, you know, four-footers in front of the rim at floaters that are much more skilled and talented than their 7'4" guy. They also have Jonathan Isaac, who's 6'10". He's athletic. He has some skill. He can go out and shoot the threes, a 35% shooter from out there. Dwayne Bacon, their 6'7", 225-pound wing, is a monster. He dunks on people's head. He loves to get out in transition. He can also shoot it from three. He likes to shoot a lot of threes. This Florida State team is going to be really difficult to match up with. There's no question about it. But they're also a team that, as you mentioned, Dan, they've laid some absolute eggs when you look at their schedule. They have, away from home, they have not been nearly the same team as they are when they play at home. And they're a team that, quite honestly, just seems to get kind of disinterested and not really locked in or focused on what their objectives are on offense or defense. They're kind of just out there playing a lot of times from what I've seen. And you saw that last night in the FGCU game. It was like, we're winning by 6-10. Who cares? You know, like, we're good. Right. Like, we don't need to put the foot down or take better care of the basketball or take better shots. We're here. And it left Florida Gulf Coast around, and the entire game, it came down the final few possessions, and Florida Gulf Coast lost by 6 points, scored 80 points against Florida State. So
right.
Is this a really difficult matchup and one that Xavier is probably going to lose? Yes, it is. Is this a game that it's feasible that Xavier could pull an upset and it's going to be one of those games that allow Xavier to probably hang around? Yeah, I think so. And that makes it really interesting because if Florida State, you know, they're going to zone, Xavier's probably going to zone them back. If this becomes a game where two teams are kind of sitting around in the zone and neither team's being super aggressive and it's a lot of jump shots, I think that absolutely favors Xavier. The more disinterested, if that's – maybe that's the wrong term, but for lack of a better one, it's what I'll say. If the more disinterested –
The more passive Florida State is, the better off Xavier's going to be.
Exactly. The more passive they can make Florida State's offense, the better off they are, even if that means they're being a little passive in their own right and kind of just getting into a little bit of a shooting contest.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting last night in the commentary, Steve Lavin really talking up Xavier's zone. My dad, shout out to my dad for a scorching take. He was like, well, Steve, your team's the St. John's never scored against it in like five opportunities. So that's probably why he thinks that zone is so effective. But I mean, your take on tomorrow is, you know, Xavier probably, they're certainly an underdog. I think the opening line was 6 points. You view this as a pretty tough matchup for Xavier, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, physically, I don't know exactly how Xavier can match up with Florida State. Physically, it doesn't make sense to me. But again, when you look at some of the games Florida State's played, no one really matches up well with them. And they still lose a decent amount, you know. I mean, not a decent amount. They lost 6 games so far this year. But some of those games, you know, at Pitt was just a terrible performance by them. At Syracuse was a terrible performance by them. At Georgia Tech was a terrible performance by them. So they've had some really bad games. You mentioned the Temple loss, too. Obviously, that was a long time ago. But that was a terrible performance. So you don't expect them to play their worst in the NCAA tournament. But if they don't play their A game or at least B-plus game, there's a great chance that Xavier could pull the upset. I would probably pick Florida State by about 4 out of 5 points, I would guess. But it wouldn't be a complete surprise to me if Xavier was able to pull the upset.
All right. Give me your strongest takes from yesterday's play. Like, what stood out to you?
Oh, I mean, you just got – how dumb can Vanderbilt be for a bunch of guys who are supposed to be brilliant, right? Like, I mean, you're supposed to be smart if you go to Vanderbilt. You're playing in a game where everyone was hyping up how smart the two schools were, Northwestern and Vanderbilt, and you turn in two of the dumbest plays at the end of a basketball game that I've ever seen, fouling inexplicably when you were up to put them at the free throw line to win it, and then shooting a contested three from way deep when you had plenty of time to work for a better shot. I just don't understand what the hell Vanderbilt was doing, and it was not
a good look for
our boy from Valparaiso.
It was an inexplicable decision, and part of the problem, part of compounding it, was the fact that Bryce Drew ran himself out of timeouts with 7 minutes left. I mean, they didn't really have the opportunity. I don't know if you would have called a timeout after LeChance scored that basket to go up a point or if you play it out, but he would have at least had the option to call the timeout and reset his defense before Northwestern got their final possession.
So are you saying there's some value in not just inexplicably burning timeouts through the game every time your team's not playing as well as you'd like? You mean saving timeouts for the end of game situations might be a decent idea?
There is, but there's also the fact that that him using those timeouts when he did with 7 minutes left, Vandy subsequently went on a massive run and got back in the game. They were down like 12 points, I want to say. But yes, your point is well taken. I feel like that was a subtweet of maybe some folks out there.
I'm just saying
maybe some GCL fans. You're trying to rile them up a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm just saying coaches have different philosophies on this, and one doesn't make the other one wrong or right. You know what I mean? Like, there's reasons to want to save your timeouts. There's reasons to want to use your timeouts, but just because your coach did it in CYO ball or in high school and said it was the right thing doesn't mean like it's the end-all be-all to basketball, you know? There's nothing magical in timeouts that says, oh, now we get to go on a run. There's, you know, I understand why people think it stops momentum, but it doesn't necessarily mean you go on a run. And some coaches feel a lot better about, hey, I actually like using my timeouts for drawing things up and running set plays and stuff when we actually need it.
Right.
So there you go.
Yeah. So I thought that was a really good game. Obviously, the end of Notre Dame Princeton was pretty, was kind of anticlimactic as well. The thing that stood out, I think, the most to me is just how is that that Middle Tennessee State team is really good. Like, I know Minnesota was pretty significantly overseeded, But Mitsu, I mean, if you're Butler, that is not that you're not probably happy to see them rather than Minnesota, who's pretty bad and who I think Butler would handle.
I totally agree. And the thing we've talked about with Butler all year, especially on the Skinny podcast, is that this Butler team is good. They can beat anyone in the country, but they don't overwhelm anyone. They're not special athletically. You know, they don't have a bunch of exceptional talents. So they're susceptible to be beaten by teams, you know, with lesser talent and lesser athleticism and size too. So that was really a second round game that's going to intrigue me tomorrow.
Yeah. So today you've got UC playing Kansas State and Dayton playing Wichita. A couple other intriguing first round matchups. How do you see the other local? And oh yeah, there's another big game too tonight. Involving Kentucky and the school named after them.
No, it's not. Golly.
So Tift is spreading. So I want your Tift is spreading your slander. Takes on the other three local teams and their. I do want to hear your take on Dayton Wichita because I think it's an interesting game.
Yeah, I think Dayton Wichita is probably going to be ugly. I like Wichita on that one. I don't care quite as much about it as everyone else seems to, but I do think it's going to be an ugly game that will be close, and I like Wichita. I don't think Dayton's that good, and also they play in the A-10. So I'll go with Wichita State. I hope yesterday was a solid day of games. You had like a lot of just good games. There weren't a bunch of blowouts, but we also didn't get any like March magic moments where any buzzer beaters happened or anything like that. Today, I hope there's a little more flair for the dramatic in the games. That's what I'm looking for.
How do you see UC and NKU coming out?
UK and NKU, I think UK will blow them out, unfortunately. If it's close for 5 minutes, though, you'll want to be around me. I can guarantee you that. Those first 5 minutes, if it's close, it's going to be wild in this household.
Will you be at Dickman's, or will you be monitoring the games from your palatial homestead?
I have no plans to leave my homestead at this point, but if they arise, they arise. Like, I'm not opposed to going out, that's for certain. If you want to see me out in these streets.
What will the atmosphere at Dickman's be, given that it is really a UK bar?
It'll be heavy UK people. A lot of the people are, I see them on Facebook now because, you know, I'm friends with all these rednecks. And it was like, you know, last week they had Norse up on their thing. And this week it's like, oh, well, that was cute and all. But like, let's get serious. Big blue. I bleed blue. Like, that's where we're going to win. We're going to crush them. And like, they're getting mad because people are saying that it could be interesting or there could be an upset, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but it's also even more ridiculous to get mad about that if you're a UK fan, like take offense to people saying you might get upset by NKU. I don't know. Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed NKU's Horizon League run, but I just don't see two, shall we say, stout 6'6" centers really getting much play against UK's front line. And then UC plays Kansas State. Kansas State is kind of an enigma to me. I don't think I've seen them play a single time all year. Seems like, but the line is only, I want to say like 3.5 or 4. So it seems like Vegas at least is giving the Wildcats a chance against UC.
Here's the situation. I mean, we just watched that Kansas State-Wake Forest game the other night. Neither one of those teams were impressive. Mick Cronin's done a whole lot of complaining the last 2 weeks towards the NCAA tournament committee and everything else. The only thing I'll say is you've got a pretty good team this year, my man. You got to go win a game. Like, of all the other stuff that's been said, and you can complain about having to play UCLA in the second round and everything else, but this game right here, you've got a major advantage, or at least you should, if you're as good as everyone's been saying all year, which I think they are. Like, I think UC is a pretty good team this year. They've got to win this one. I mean, things happen, teams get hot, whatever. There could be a fluke, but to me, if I'm Mick Cronin and I'm UC, this is a must-win NCAA tournament game. You've got to advance the second round this year, especially with that matchup. I'm excited about this game. I think it's a pressurized game for UC fans. I'm sure they're going to be nervous as all get out. It should be fun. I'm looking forward to that one.
All right. I think that probably does it for us. So, yeah, Muskies in Florida State, and the game's at 6 tomorrow, is that correct?
Yeah, 6:10 on TNT. You'll have Lavin, or no, Ian Eagle and Steve Lavin. So calling the game, it should be pretty good. And we've got a special guest coming up. The podcast is not over. So let's take – you got anything else to say, Dan, before
I have nothing else to say.
All right. Well, enjoy the games, my man, and let's get into this interview.
Let's go Norse. Bye.
All right, and our special guest on the podcast is a friend of the podcast now. He's been on here a few times with us, and he needs no introduction. He's the on-demest of them all. He is C.J. Anderson. And, C.J., you've never been in the position that the Xavier team is in. And you were a three and a four seed when you guys made the NCAA tournament both times, so you were a high seed. You were never in this position of being an 11 seed. But as you said last night, at Xavier, this is – wins in March are expected, right? They don't view this as being an underdog.
Right. Yeah, we're not underdogs at all. It's tournament. We coming in to win, so we expect to win, and that's what we did last night. But now we don't do the underdog stuff. We don't do that.
Take me through, like, from the mentality of a team. Do you look at the NCAA tournament as, is it a time, does it feel refreshing? Is it like a new season for you? Or is it more of a thing where, hey, we gained some momentum at the end of the season, we want to keep this rolling? How is kind of the mindset of the team when you approach the NCAA tournament?
I think it's a little bit of both. It just really depends on how you finish up coming down, like towards the conference tournament and stuff like that. But so yeah, for us, when I was in school, we just wanted to. It was like we didn't do good in the conference tournament, so like yeah, we get to start over. We know what time it is. Let's go make it happen. So with this team, I think it was a new start for them, whatever, especially with all the injuries and Ed being gone, Trayvon being hurt. So now he's back. We got some chemistry going right now. So hopefully, you know, we can keep it rolling.
You watched last night's game. Dan and I just got done talking about it, and we talked about Sean O'Mara's play. How surprised are you by what you've seen from Sean O'Mara over the last few weeks?
Oh, I've been very surprised. I didn't expect what I got from him last night, and we needed it. So it was good to see. I have seen him play in open gym a couple times last year, as I didn't get to play in open gym with him this past summer. But when I seen him play, I'm like, he's going to be pretty good. He's big, he's strong. And earlier in the season, I'm like, what's going on? But he definitely came to play last night. I was very excited by his play last night.
What does it take for a big man? Like, what is the difference between what we were seeing from Sean earlier in the year? Because it's not just a lack of opportunity. He got the opportunity to start early in the season, and he wasn't able to do anything with it. He really struggled. Mm-hmm. And then there was a point during the season where he was barely playing at all. What does it take for a big man to sort of to make that step into where you're able to contribute and you're able to provide points and rebounding, all that stuff? What's the difference between what he's doing now and what he was doing early in the season when he wasn't being able to provide that type of thing?
To me, last night, it's just like he was just playing. Earlier in the year, like he was thinking a lot, trying not to mess up, trying to be perfect. Last night, just like he was just out there. He was confident in what he was doing. His moves were strong. It was fluid. So he looked like a whole different player to me last night. So I just think it was a confidence thing. And, you know, he got in his mind. Like I said, that's a big dude. Like, it ain't a lot of guys his size that's guarding him that he's going to play against. So I think he just got in his mind that I'm bigger than everybody else, and they're just going to have to stop me. So, and that's how he played last night.
Obviously, Trayvon had a big second half. Have you seen him take another step late in the season from where? And Brad Redford had talked about this where before the crosstown shootout. He said great shooters, they're able to adjust mid-game. When they're not having a good game, they're able to figure out what's going wrong. You know, maybe they're a little long, maybe they're a little short, whatever. Get some more legs into it. Whatever the adjustment is, they're able to make that and then start shooting better within a game. We've seen Trayvon do that over the final weeks of the season. Have you seen him take a step forward from where he was at, maybe even last season when he was at his best?
Yeah, I think he did. I think a lot of it, well, not a lot of it, but a part of this season, like toward the end when he was kind of struggling, was he was playing hurt. And with Ed being now, I think he was trying to just do a little too much instead of staying within the flow. And last night in the first half for me, like, he was just rushing. Like, he was a little antsy, just trying to go too fast. And then second half, he came out, and he played like Trayvon. So he's definitely closing. He's closed, like I like to say, he closed the show. He turned off the open sign, and we're closed, man. He closed it up for us last night.
What else stuck out to you about last night's performance by the Xavier team?
Quinn Gooden played a fantastic game. I wasn't sure how good he was going to be toward the beginning of the year, obviously, because Ed was playing a lot of the minutes, so I didn't see a lot of him. I didn't know how good he was, but he played really good last night, and so did Kaiser. So I've been tough on Kaiser all year, so it was important for me to go ahead and give him his props last night. He played really good.
You've seen, obviously, some really good point guards at Xavier, and since you've been at Xavier and following them over the years, what do you think of Quentin Gooden's upside going forward?
Oh, I think he's going to be good. He has poise. He's calm. I didn't really see him rushing and making a lot of rush decisions. He did a couple times, but that's because he's a freshman. But as he gets older, I think he's going to be really, really good.
Just looking ahead, they're going to play a Florida State team that's big. They're athletic. It's a tough matchup, but at the same time, it's a Florida State team that's had some inconsistencies and have struggled at times. What is the biggest key as you continue to move along in the tournament? Is there something that sticks out to you as, like, you've got to be a team that does this? You got to be a team that defends or rebounds or whatever. Is there something that you think that's most important as you move along and play the tougher games in the NCAA tournament?
Going against a team like Florida State, they have, since I can remember with Hamilton being the coach, they always pressed a lot. So, like I was complaining about yesterday, we had 8 turnovers in the first half. When we do that against a team like Florida State, we're going to get ran out the gym. So we got to value possessions, take care of the ball. Most definitely, we got to take care of the ball. Like I said, they press a lot.
All right, we've got some questions. I asked people coming off Twitter to you know, throw questions at you if they had them. DJ Hodge, who you know well, wants to know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how scared were you in the bus in New Jersey from the airport to the hotel before the Duke game?
No, out of 1 through 10, like 9.5. That was a dangerous situation.
Well, what happened? I'm unfamiliar with this story, I guess.
Man, it was just so bad. The weather was so bad. Everything was bad. Like, it was all around bad, 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 bad. Anything you could think of, it was bad.
All right. Obviously, I still get the last time you were on this podcast, which was over a year ago. I still get that, but it was right before the Villanova game, if people forget, when Xavier beat Villanova at the Cintas Center when Villanova was ranked number one. So we kind of really wait to bring CJ out for the big games when Xavier needs a big win. He's kind of now like the good luck charm or the guy who sends good vibes to the team before a big game. So that's why he's on today. But you told a story on that one about Drew Lavender's first story window at his dorm that people bring that up to me still to this day, like once a month at least. So one of the people on Twitter says, what is the best Chris Mack story you have? But I will amend this. If you have a good story to tell us about someone else that you want to share that you've been thinking like, oh, I should have told that on the podcast, we'll take any story you've got, because last time you were money on this section.
Chris Mack. What's a good Chris Mack one? I don't know. Coach Mack, he was pretty mellow back then. Well, you know what? I got a good one. We was NCAA tournament. We was in D.C. We had practice, and we were doing like a tape charge drill. So he was just coming down, hitting us with the ball. Then Jason Love stepped up. He came down. He took off. He dunked on Jason Love so hard. Coach Miller, he ended it. No more practice. It was over. He dunked on him. We all laughed. It was hilarious.
Wait, Coach Mack dunked on him?
Oh, hard. Hard.
This must have been before hard. The second ACL injury.
Yeah, he was a little younger back then. He was a little younger back then. He surprised everybody. Like I said, you know, we're just going through the motion, running up, pitching with the ball. You take the charge, fall down, get back in the line.
Right.
Love came up. I don't know if he had it planned in his mind or what, but yeah, he got him poster action, straight poster action.
We were talking about your trips to the NCAA tournament. Obviously, you had some really good experiences in the NCAA tournament. You were you lost in the Sweet 16 to Pittsburgh in 2009. In 2008, you were part of that Elite Eight team that went on to play just a UCLA team that how they didn't win a national championship is still stunning. I mean, Russell Westbrook, Kevin Love, just an absolutely loaded team. What's your favorite memory or your favorite game from your two NCAA tournament trips?
My favorite one would probably have to be the game against West Virginia. That was a good game. That was a high-level game. And then Derrick Brown fouled out, I fouled out, and BJ happened. So that was amazing. Me and Derrick was on the sideline looking at each other like, what have we done? We fouled out. And BJ came and pulled us up out the grave.
79-75 overtime win. I don't think any Xavier fans will forget that one.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. That was the first time I ever been a part of winning a game like that. Stanley threw the worst pass in history, and it just bounced to BJ. God was looking out for us. It bounced to BJ, and bang, he knocked it down. If the refs was looking, we probably would have got 10. We was jumping on the floor and everything. It was crazy.
Not to bring up a sore subject, but obviously you did face that UCLA team in the next round, lost 76-57. At the time that you were playing those guys, were you all looking around like, what the hell is that? Like, they've got a bunch of NBA dudes on that roster. Why are they not better? Or what were you guys thinking?
Nah, I mean, when we found out who we was going to play, we just was like, man, we going to beat them. Like, well, I didn't think they was that good. I mean, I knew they was good, but, man, listen, we started off the game, it was kind of close, and they just took off on them. I don't know what it happened. It happened very quick. Russell Westbrook happened. That's when I knew he was better than Darren Collison. I'm like, man, we talking about this about Darren Collison. Who was this other dude? Like, he's everywhere doing everything.
Did you ever think, like, after you saw him in that game, did you think, oh, he's going to be a stud in the pros? Did you know he would, I mean, not maybe turn out to be what he is now, but turn out to be a good pro? Did you think that at the time?
Yeah. I definitely thought that. But he was just, so fast, so explosive. And he played angry and he plays full throttle. And that was, he was like that in UCLA. He liked that now. It was pretty much the same guy.
Speaking of UCLA, I've seen you tweeting. This is one of my favorite topics in college sports right now. You've obviously got the Ball family situation going on. LeVar Ball cracks me up. I also think what he's doing is very interesting because it's working. And he's basically running a PR campaign. I think his goal is to essentially turn his family into like a basketball version of the Kardashians. Like, he wants to have a reality TV show. He wants to control their endorsement deals. He wants to be rich and wants to not turn all the control over their fame to a middleman who's going to take a large cut. And I think a lot of that is noble, and it's a good idea. It's a smart idea. I think a lot of people don't like it because they're not used to it. They're uncomfortable with it. What's been your take on this whole LeVar Ball thing? Is he setting his kids up for failure? Do you like how he's handling this, or is it a major issue? What's your take on it all?
I'm like 50-50 on it. Some of the stuff he be saying, like, I'm starting to realize he's just saying it for TV, but sometimes I don't know if he really believes it. Like, I don't know. Like, he's saying he can beat Michael Jordan. Like, I don't know if he really believes that, but he's saying it with confidence. But like you said, reality, he's definitely going to get a reality show. They're going to get a reality show. Most of the stuff he's talking about is probably going to happen outside the billion-dollar thing. That's not happening.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole point, right? Like, the Michael Jordan stuff, the $1 billion figure he's throwing out, he doesn't care about that. He doesn't really believe in that. He just knows at this point, he's so viral that no matter what he says, the media is going to print it like it's an important story, and they'll put it on First Take, and they'll put it on every ESPN talk show. And hell, even me in Cincinnati will talk about it on my podcast. So he's willing to say anything at this point just to get people talking. That, at least in my opinion, that's what he's doing. And then there's a certain few things that he's really passionate about, which is like, you know, trying to get that endorsement deal where they're in control of it, probably trying to get a reality TV show down the line for his family. Some things like that, I think, are his overall plan. And all the other stuff is just – it's distractions, and it's a way to keep him relevant every week in the news.
Yeah, but also, yeah, it's kind of, it's also a tribute to, you know, how good his kids are. If they was bums, wouldn't nobody care what he was talking about? That just mean they actually could play. If Lonzo was a whack, wouldn't nobody care about none of that. If the youngest one didn't score 92, wouldn't nobody care. Now, the middle one, he don't really get a lot of pub, but you know, I think that's probably a lot of it, too. The Lonzo get a lot of pub. The youngest one get a lot of pub. I think he's trying to help the middle one out a lot, too, because he don't get a lot of pub like that. So it's a well put together plan. So, I mean, I can't be mad at him. You know, you're putting a lot of utmost confidence in his kids, which is, you know, that's definitely commendable. And like I said, he doing it for the family, so it's a grand scheme to it. It's a grand scheme to it. We'll see how it turns out as far as how good they are at the next level. Lonzo, NBA, then the other two when they get to college. But you know, it's right now he must see TV. Every time he's on the TV screen, I watch at least for a few minutes.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I've enjoyed talking about him all year on our various podcasts. Let's get back to this year's NCAA tournament. Are you a bracket guy? Do you fill out a bracket?
Nah, you know what? I ain't did a bracket in like 3 years. I ain't even looked at the bracket this year. As soon as I fill out a bracket, Gonzaga would have lost that game. If I would have filled out a bracket and said Gonzaga, they would have lost. Like, as soon as my brackets be through after the first day, I've got to just take mine and throw it away. So I said, you know what? I'm going to pick Xavier to go to the Sweet 16. And they don't kill me, y'all, but I got Arizona going at least to the Elite Eight.
That's funny. I'm the same way. I haven't done a bracket in like 6 or 7 years. And the thing I hate is it's like fantasy football guy, right? Like you're in your house, you're a Bengals fan, and someone comes over and he's upset because a Bengals player scored that he's playing against in fantasy, right? Like that's the absolute worst to me. You get bracket guy does the same thing. Like you're in your house, you're hoping that a 15 seed pulls off an upset, and he's going, oh, I don't want that. I've got the 2 seed going to the Final Four. It's like, dude, get out of here. I don't care about your bracket right now. So that drives me nuts. It's why I don't do brackets. But that being said, you mentioned you do have a few picks. Did you have like a finals pick? Do you have any team that you expect to win it all this year or at least make the finals?
Well, if it can't be Xavier, I wanted to be Arizona just because of Coach Miller. But if not them, like, just looking at it overall, I would probably say that I'm trying to think. They always get Kansas that – I don't know how they get that type of draw every year. Kansas got a good chance to make it to the Final Four. Let me see. If I had the best of money, I probably would say I think UCLA got a good chance to go to the final. My Final Four would probably be UCLA, Arizona, North Carolina. Hopefully I ain't picking a team that's on the same side of the bracket. UCLA, North Carolina.
Yeah, UCLA and North Carolina Arizona. would meet in the Elite Eight. They're in the same South bracket.
Oh, damn. All right, well, I'm gonna take UCLA in that case then, because I think Lonzo Ball's gonna kill Joe Berry. So I'm gonna go with UCLA, Duke in the Final Four. UCLA, Duke, Arizona, and
Kansas.
What was the other team I said?
Kansas.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that possible for all them teams to make it?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then, so I was. Out of them teams, I would probably end up saying, "Oh, we might get Duke, North Carolina in the national championship."
Yeah, I had
that. That would be crazy.
I have Duke, Kentucky in mind, so I could definitely see that happening. I had Kentucky beat North Carolina to get there, so that makes sense to me.
I want to pick Kentucky, but they'd be going like different. They don't show up out of time. Like I don't know. Sometimes they'd be laying eggs. Like, what they doing?
Yeah.
And if Malik Monk ain't going, even though De'Aaron Fox is tremendous, I love the way he plays, but they're going to need him and Malik Monk to have outstanding games to beat. Who you say was going to play?
They would play North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Yep, if they both make it that far. So my take on Kentucky.
They already played this year, didn't they?
Yes, yeah.
That's when Malik Monk had like 40.
Yeah, he went nuts and Kentucky won that game. But then Kentucky would also have to get past UCLA first before they played North Carolina. So they have a difficult road. My thing with Kentucky, my take on Kentucky is this. I totally agree with you about they have some games where they just do not show up. But on the flip side of that, I don't think they've played a good team where they haven't showed up. So, like, to me, I think they play to the level of their competition, and they're always in the game. And then I think they're the best closing team in college basketball because no one can keep Fox in front of them. They've got a big-time shot maker who loves taking the last shot in Monk, and they've got a big man at the rim who's impossible to keep off the offensive glass. So if you go try to stop that initial shot, there's a second left. He's great for tip-ins as well. I like them closing games out. That's why I have them going to the finals and losing to Duke.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I can see that. I would like – did they play UCLA already too?
Yeah, they lost to UCLA at home.
Oh, yeah. Now, if they played them again, they'd beat them. So, I'd take Kentucky. I'd take Kentucky in that one.
There you go, people. I just talked CJ into it. How about that influence?
yeah, you just talked me right into it.
All right. Just wrapping this thing up, you've been great with your time once again. Are there any more NCAA tournament stories or anything that you know, this time of year it reminds you of or stirs up for you that you want to tell us about? Because, as you know, the fans love any former Xavier stories they can get out of you.
Tournaments. But I mean, because everything is pretty. It's pretty tight around tournament time. Like, we're not doing a whole bunch of different stuff like that. So I mean, everything is pretty mellow. What's a good Tennessee?
Yeah, like no one's missing curfew or sneaking out during tournament time, right? Like everyone's actually their room during the tournament.
Yeah. And we did that somewhere else, but not in the NCAA tournament though. Yeah. Oh man!
That's great.
No, I got to go ahead and tell you about this one.
Okay.
Was playing George Washington at George Washington, and this was this the league? Yeah, I guess it was. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it was. So we won the game, and you know we in D.C. So they like, you know, after the game, everybody standing, won't nobody leave the hotel, whatever. But I had met this chick like right before the game where we was about to go to shoot around or something. And I had seen this girl walking from across the street. So I ended up getting her number or whatever.
What was the line? Give us CJ Anderson's line when you're in George Washington and you see a girl from across the street that you want to talk to. What's the line you pull out?
What did I say? I don't even remember.
You just said I'm a 6'5 basketball player, 6'6 basketball player.
We was getting on the bus. No, I ain't say nothing. Like, I probably said something about playing for Xavier. Like,
exactly. That's all you need to say.
Because I was rushing because we was about to get on the bus to go to shoot around, and we was about to go somewhere. So I had ran across the street. Oh, you know what's up? You coming to the? You go to George Washington? Yeah, you coming to the game? Blah blah. So I got her number, whatever. So I had seen her at the game. She had looked better at the game than earlier. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to call her after this game. And I played good, too. So I'm like, yeah, I got to call her as soon as I get back to the hotel. Call her, like, boom, what's up, girl? She's like, yeah. She stayed on campus. She's like, yeah, I'll come get you. So I'm like, all right. I had thought about it at first. I'm like, all right, come on. So then she ended up coming. So it's me and somebody else was walking out towards the front. we seen the coaches, either they was leaving or they was coming back from somewhere. So we hiding behind, like, plants outside in front of the hotel. We dug down. It had to be me and Drew. That was the only other person who was, or it was AD. Me, Drew, and AD, and somebody else were probably the ones doing this. So we ducking down. Like, where they at? Where they at? So them fools got scared and went back in the hotel. About 2 minutes later, the girl came and picked me up, and that's a story for another day.
And it sounds like it was worth the hide. However many minutes you had to hide, sounds like it was worth it. So shout out to Drew Lavender.
Yes, indeed.
Constantly a victim during CJ Anderson's story time here on this podcast. He always somehow gets dragged into the mix, but we could enjoy it more. CJ, really appreciate the time. You mentioned on Twitter you're looking into starting a podcast. What's the direction for this podcast? Any idea of what you want to do?
Like first take type of thing, you know, the back and forth debate, different topics and stuff like that.
Just overall on sports, are you going to stick to sports or just anything?
No, I'll probably do anything because I'm not really into baseball and stuff like that. So, you know, after basketball season, I have to find something to talk about.
All right. Well, let us know when you get it up and running. We will certainly tweet the heck out of it and promote it on here. And hopefully we can do this again soon if Xavier wins another game or two here in the tournament.
Oh, yeah, they're going to win. We're going to the 16. They're going to win, so we can set something up for the next game.
All right. Sounds perfect. Thanks a lot for the time, man. That's CJ Anderson. Look him up on Twitter, @C_Wheeze, correct?
Yes, sir.
Best Xavier live tweet you can get during a game. So make sure you follow that for tomorrow night's game. CJ, appreciate it, man.
No problem.
You've been listening to another edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. For CJ Anderson and Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.